You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. And our topic today is resisting empire in the book of Romans. And our guests are, we have two guests today, Jared.
I was thinking that. I don't know if we've actually had two guests on at one time.
But they're like married, so we had to do this.
Yeah.
Right. So
anyway, I think they actually are married, though. I don't think they just like married.
They are married.
So just
they better
clear
be
that
anyway.
Up.
But they live in the same house. Yeah, no, anyway. Sylvia Kiesmott, who is a biblical scholar, and her husband, Brian Walsh, who is a theologian. And they just wrote a book on Romans, which we'll get into a little bit, and they'll talk about it too. And it was we had a good time talking about reading Romans from a very different angle. That's really what it came down to.
Yeah, and I appreciate being able to read I would say read creatively, but one thing I kept coming back to is, you know, there is something important about putting into how we think of the Bible today in the social context of when Romans was written. And so I couldn't get over that fact. We talk a lot about the social context. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that because tend to be very individualistic. And so even like reading Romans now, even thinking through this conversation, it's like hard to get away from an individualistic mm-hmm. perspective that I just grew up with. So it's sort of ingrained in me. And so what may feel to me like they're reading into a lot of things or that seems a little foreign may just be my own bias toward having read Romans so individualistically my whole life.
And wrongly, really, is what they're saying. And yeah, because it's, you know, how do you apply Romans to your life? Well, here's a verse. And we don't all do this, but it's a common assumption that we just assume the cultures are like the same or fundamentally the same. We mm-hmm. have the same questions. And that's not true. You know, there are social contexts in the ancient world that are very, very foreign to ours, but on another level, there are similarities. And, you know, we have political systems. They had political systems. You know, they had struggles with class. We have struggles with class and economics and issues of justice. But, you know, getting into that, it sort of really unlocks Romans in a sense. It helps you understand things from a different point of view. And, you know, they talk about things like what salvation means, for example. That's a really interesting thing to think about in the ancient world, and it might not be what we sometimes assume it means.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that we don't get into a lot, but I think is actually really important is just how practical. So while they teach, they also live on a farm and do a lot of permaculture. And so there's just something to that I really appreciate. There's a practical element to how they live out their faith in ways that maybe a lot of us wouldn't consider.
Yeah, they're trying to live in that alternate kingdom mode that Romans is really trying. What Paul is trying to do in Romans is portray an alternate kingdom to the dominant one, which is very opposite and very countercultural. You know, so when we look at people who live on a farm and they adjunct teach and they preach and they write books and, you know, they're off the grid. That's a statement of faith, really, in a way.
You know, very practical, like life behavior altering, lifestyle altering way.
Right.
Yeah.
Which makes me really ashamed because I have a smartphone.
Well, you know, that's what they really wanted is to have you be ashamed. That's great.
It's always about me.
Yeah,
isn't it,
that's right. You and your shame.
That's what I think. Yeah. It's all about me. So anyway.
All right. Well, let's get to this conversation and have it be less about you.
Okay.
All right.
You know, Jesus' death on the cross isn't because God was so angry that somebody had to die to kind of satisfy God's wrath. So why did Jesus die in Romans? Because God loved us so much that he was willing to offer himself up for us. That's how reconciliation happens in Jesus.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe, Ferrero Rocher, je 200 Gramm Packung, nur 2,99 €.
Außerdem Mionetto Prosecco Spumante Doc, je 0,75 Liter Flasche nur 5,99 Euro. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
Sylvia, Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Where is here? You're from some other country.
Here is your northern security threat.
I know. Here's, you know, seriously, I'm going to build a wall because I've had it. Yeah. I'm just going to like start a Kickstarter. You people are just too much sometimes. But anyway.
We're in the middle of Ontario in Canada in a small hamlet called Cameron, Ontario.
Oh, wow.
Excellent. And as good Americans, we have no idea what you're talking about.
That's right.
It sounds peaceful, though.
So, and we live on a farm, and chores have been done. Animals are mostly taken care of, and we're ready to have a conversation.
Well, that's a great segue here to say, you know, we're here to talk about the Bible. We're going to actually talk about the book of Romans in particular, but you also have a farm, and you have a lot of things going on. So just maybe give us a little background on how you became trained in, interested in the Bible, and maybe what you do now, and how does that relate?
Sure. Why don't I start? I became interested in the Bible as a 16-year-old who converted to following Jesus, and that gave me an insatiable interest and desire to learn more and more about the Bible. And the more I think about it, it was that I knew where the dominant story of my culture was going, and the best it could offer me was kind of suburban boredom, and deciding to follow Jesus just opened up a whole new story and a whole new narrative. So I've just wanted to go deeper and deeper into that so that I would know my identity and know what calls me in my life.
And I had a completely different story from Brian. Grew up deeply embedded in the Christian Reformed Church and heard very deep biblical preaching every week. And when it was really boring, I picked up the Bible and read it and got excited from just reading it all the time and wanted very early on to help people understand it. And so I'm a biblical scholar who freelances now and works as a biblical scholar in residence at our local Anglican church, teaching lay people how to read the Bible and what the Bible's actually about. And I teach part-time at the University of Toronto as well, and basically try to sort of help people imagine what it's like to live into this story and try to imagine what it was like for people in the first century to live into this story and what we might learn from that.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I think that brings us right into the main topic today, which is looking at the book of Romans. And And your understanding of that, which is not down the center. It's you know, I mean, you echo things that people say, but you have a really interesting take on Romans as anti-imperial, which is not, I mean, you know, I mean, Jared and I, we both grew up with some of this stuff, but, you know, a typical way of reading Romans is it's a book of how you get saved.
Yeah.
And that's really all it is. It's sort of like systematic theology boiled down in sort of a letter form.
Well, you get the Romans Road, and the rest is just kind of ancillary extra stuff.
Yeah.
That means you don't really know what to do with most of the letter, if you think of it that way. But, you know, others, you know, scholarly trends like the New Perspective on Paul, which really takes into account the Jewish background and stuff. But there, you know, at least in my experience, you guys know better than we do, but a lot of it is, you know, it's a good thing to talk about Jewish-Gentile relations and how building the community of God in this volatile place, Rome, is sort of like the point of the book. But you guys go a little bit deeper, and you talk about its anti-imperial focus if you just know where to look for it.
Yeah, and the Romans Road way of reading Romans actually was right about something. Romans is about salvation. The question is, what is salvation, and salvation from what, you know, and you know, what are the forces that we need to be saved from? And one of the things that the New Perspective has taught us is that individualistic kind of reading of Romans together with the rest of the Bible, where it's all about my guilty conscience and how I will get my life right with God so that I can be saved and go to heaven, totally misses, I think, not only the theology of Romans, but misses the historical context in which Romans was written.
Maybe can you go a little bit further into that? What is that context, and help us understand why it's legitimate to read Romans as resisting empire? And you give us a little bit of that background and context, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I mean, Paul was, first of all, deeply steeped in the story of Israel, right? His scriptures. But also, he was a Jew who had grown up in Tarsus. He knew all the other cultural stories that surrounded him. And we see some of those stories in the cities that he traveled to. For instance, when he was in Ephesus, there was this riot because the worshipers of Artemis thought that the gospel was a challenge to the, well, actually to their business practices around Artemis. But it's clear that the gospel was coming into conflict with the narratives of the gods, right? Of other gods and goddesses at the time. But also, those other narratives were deeply tied in with the stories of Rome and Roman power and Roman rule. And so the language that Paul uses in Romans, a lot of his vocabulary is vocabulary that would have been used by the empire. For instance, the word gospel, which in Greek is euangelion, good news, literally it means.
We get evangelical from, right?
Where we get the word evangelical from. And that was a word used by the empire to describe the good news of Caesar's victories. So Caesar's good news was always bad news for the people that he had defeated, right?
Mm-hmm.
This, Paul is talking about a different good news. And that's why at the beginning of Romans, he talks about the good news of God, the good news of his son, the good news is qualified by him a number of times before he uses it without qualification. And that's because he's making clear it's a different gospel. The word salvation was used to talk about how Caesar brought salvation for all the peoples of the world. The phrase Son of God, Paul uses that obviously to refer to Jesus, but the Caesars were considered to be the son of a god because every time, when Julius Caesar died, he became one of the gods. And so Augustus became the son of a god. And so there's all these terms that were used by Paul that had ramifications and that echoed in people's imaginations. And so they would have heard echoes of that other story when Paul used that kind of language.
Okay. Well, okay, so let's back up for a second because both you and Brian mentioned the word salvation. So what would that have meant in that Greco-Roman world of, say, Caesar, and contrast that with how the Bible is using it? Because like you said before, Brian, it's not this individualistic thing. It's something else, right? So just help us understand those two and maybe compare and contrast those two uses of the word salvation.
Yeah, so here's the interesting thing. When Rome talks about salvation and when Paul talks about salvation, they actually are talking about the same thing. They're talking about political liberation. They're talking about the defeat of their foes. So Israel, whenever the language of salvation is used in Israel's scriptures, it's always in a political context. And Paul means it in a political context as well. And of course he does. He follows Jesus, who proclaimed a kingdom, a basileia, same word that is used for empire. So what we have here is a contrast and a conflict between different kingdoms, different political visions. So the contrast isn't whether it's political or not, or political or individual. Nobody in the first century would have thought the salvation was purely individual. The contrast is, who is the Lord of this kingdom? How is this kingdom achieved? Is it achieved by means of the violent defeat of one's enemies? Or is it achieved by means of the suffering of your king, right? Where does the suffering go? So this Paul and Israel and Rome all will understand salvation to be political. The nature of the kingdom and how the kingdom is achieved is where the radical difference happens. The idea that salvation was for individuals to get their conscience right would have been as alien in the empire as it was to Paul himself.
So, okay, so we use another, I think, a loaded term here that maybe we want to take a minute to unpack, and that's political or politics. So if we get any feedback on this podcast, probably more often than anything else, it's, hey, I really liked this until you got political. And usually what they mean is some sort of like partisan, it felt like you were taking sides on this political divide that we are experiencing in our culture now. So when you use the word politics or political, how are you using that in terms of what Romans is trying to accomplish?
Well, I think maybe perhaps the best way to answer that is to just talk about the whole shape of the biblical narrative. I mean, the whole biblical story is about how is a kingdom or a people shaped on earth that shows what it's like to the whole world, what it's like when people actually follow God faithfully. What kind of a community is shaped when people are obedient to God? You know, that's what the Torah, the law, was about in the Old Testament. You know, what does this community look like? Even the call of Abraham wasn't a call to an individual. You know, it doesn't say that Abraham was called and God said, Abraham, I'm calling you to have a close personal relationship with me.
No,
right? I mean,
that's a good point. I mean, that's a point that's lost very quickly.
Well, yeah. I mean, the call to Abraham was, your descendants are going to be a blessing to the whole of the earth, right? To all the other nations of the world. I mean, Abraham was the beginning of a communal solution, or maybe even salvation, to the problem of sin that had infected all peoples on the earth. So throughout the whole Old Testament, God was trying to shape this people. Well, shaping a community, shaping a kingdom, is what we would call political, right? The shape of a community, how a community comports itself, how it looks after the most vulnerable, how it deals with money, how a community cares for the land or not. all of these things fall under the purview of our political life, how we organize ourselves socially. And so when Jesus comes in the New Testament and starts telling people that this is what community looks like, this is how you care for one another, this is who is welcomed into the community, this is how you handle money in the community, this is how you ensure that nobody has too much money in the community. I mean, these are all things Jesus talked about. That's all very political. If you look at the pages of our newspapers, those are the kinds of things we're talking about when we talk about politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially now in the U.S., you know, who are we welcoming in or not? How are we handling money or not? Are we caring for
the land?
There'll
be no criticism of the American political system on this podcast. I'm sorry. I'm kidding, by the way.
Yeah,
so go ahead. Hey, you know, the thing is, we have to be critical of any political system, I guess. That's the point, right?
That's exactly it. I mean, every country in the world is talking about these issues as part of their political discourse, right? For good or for ill. And so when Paul starts talking about, in Romans, when he talks about what it is to live faithfully, when he talks in Romans 12 about who they should welcome and who they should eat with and how the community should deal with enemies, all of that's very political language, right? Because it's about the shape of the community and how you comport yourselves in a certain political climate that may or may not welcome those particular kinds of ideas.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Ein Barra ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Le
Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I remember correctly, what may have caused the tensions in the church in Rome is the expulsion of Jews and then their coming back. So you've got this mixed group in the epicenter of the universe at the time, and how they treat each other, how they act, will reflect something of the nature of the true kingdom.
Yes, exactly. One of the ways that we could read Romans is Paul's not writing systematic theology. He's writing a letter. He's writing a letter to real people in a real context that happens to be at the very center of the Roman Empire. And he's writing a letter to a community of people who are not functioning very well as community. They are, in fact, in many ways, mimicking the way in which the empire itself functions. So there's controversy at mealtime together. There's controversy about who is in and who is out. There's suspicion. And so what Paul is doing is he's writing into that situation and saying, if you follow Lord Jesus and not Lord Caesar, then that will shape how this community will comport itself and who it will welcome and how it will engage in its economic life and how it will engage its neighbor and indeed how it will engage its enemies. So one of my problems over the years reading Romans was it always seemed like there's an argument going on here that I don't really understand. Mm-hmm. It has to do with Jews and Gentiles, but it's not my argument. It must have been important then, but I don't get it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now if I come to Romans and say, what's going on in Romans is that Paul is trying to shape a community. And he's trying to shape a community that could really be appropriately described as home. He's trying to make home at the heart of an empire that renders so many homeless.
Mm.
Not only are Jews rendered homeless because they are under such suspicion, but we think that the vast majority of the community of followers of Jesus in the various churches, various gatherings in the city of Rome, we think that most of those folks were probably marginalized, were economically living at a subsistence level, and were having a hard time at making home together socially, economically, and spiritually. So what happens if we read Romans through the eyes of homemaking? I think an interesting kind of take starts to happen, because what is crucial to home but a story? Right? Home is always a storied place. So what if the story, the dominant story of your culture is the story of Augustus, is the story of the empire, which renders you homeless, but you are invited to follow an alternative Lord and therefore be welcomed into an alternative story that shapes your imagination, gives you meaning, and gives you a sense of connection with other folks who also are living out of that story.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. This is David Krober from Roswell, Georgia, and I'm part of the producers group here at the Bible for Normal People. Two things I've appreciated about this podcast are the affirmation that I'm not alone in wrestling with how to take seriously this wonderfully diverse and sometimes weird sacred book that we have, and the exposure to other voices and the ongoing discussion of what it looks like to be a thoughtful Christian in our culture. If you've gotten something from this free podcast, I want to take a moment to mention how you can support Pete and Jared and their work. This podcast is brought to you by supporters on the Patreon platform. For as little as a dollar a month, you can be part of the group that brings this podcast to normal people everywhere. And as a gift for your support, we have book studies, chat groups, and lots of really exciting videos from Pete and Jared. So check it out at patreon.com/thebibleformnormalpeople. If you aren't able to support the show financially, please go to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, which can go a long way to help others find us. One group in particular we want to thank is our producers group, who work hard to tell Pete and Jared where they're messing up and how to do better. Thanks to Joel Herring, Chuck Beam, Joel Thompson, Jacqueline Van Beek, Romulo Morishita, Stephen Goulstone, Joe Johnson, and Aaron Neff. The Bible for Normal People couldn't happen without you. Now, back to the podcast.
So, I mean, you're really reading Romans in a social, cultural, historical context, and the societal interactions there are just very important for, I think, for what you're saying, for understanding the book as a whole and what Paul's point is, perhaps.
Well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, and those societal interactions are actually at the heart of the book. You know, we tend to think of Romans as being about righteousness, right? And but the Greek word for righteousness is actually a word, dikaiosune, that is a translation of two words in the Hebrew. And those Hebrew words are the words tzedakah, righteousness, and mishpat, justice. And both those words are translated with the one word in the Greek, which means that that word, dikaiosune, has always the overtones of both justice and righteousness. And our Bibles in English just tend to translate that word as righteousness. If you're reading Romans in Spanish, say, that word is translated justice all the time. So it appears then that Romans is actually about justice if you're reading it in Spanish. So what one of the things that we do is whenever we're reading Romans, we try to use the word justice every time the word righteousness occurs. And then suddenly you realize this is a book about justice and injustice. So the beginning in chapter 118, which says that God's wrath is revealed against all wickedness, is how it's usually translated, but that word is actually injustice. God's wrath is revealed against injustice. And once you start thinking, wait a minute, then what is that injustice? What did it look like? It looked like violence, we see later on in Romans 1. It looked like economic violence. It looks like exclusion. In chapter 3, you get language that's completely tied up with the poor and oppressing the poor, because Paul quotes a whole bunch of Psalms, all of which are about oppressing the poor. So there seems to be something about economic justice underlying what Paul is talking about. And of course, when you get to chapter 12, when Paul starts talking about sharing what you have economically with those in the community and with those outside of the community, when he starts talking about who you eat with in chapter 14 and 15, which is an economic question too, right? Who's welcome to the table or not? You start to see that those wider social and cultural relationships are all to be constituted by righteousness, by justice in the community. And that's because God is a God of righteousness or of justice, right? This is a God who practices justice. So all of that starts to stand out much more strongly when you read the letter, sort of thinking about what the words actually mean.
Right. Well, and I would imagine too that, see, righteousness, I would contend, righteousness is not a bad word to use. The problem is that we've sort of co-opted that in Christian culture to mean sort of an inner disposition or something, when it has to do with right actions, and we're dealing with justice at that point. So that there's a real intermingling. So it's probably good to use the word justice instead of righteousness, only because of how righteousness has come to be understood. Like, yeah. There's this deep down stain inside of me, and that's all that it means. No, it means how you treat other people.
Outside of the church, it's not a word that's used unless you call somebody self-righteous, right?
Yes.
And that's not very nice. But outside of the church—
That's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to explain Christian faith to people who've never heard anything about this and you start talking about righteousness, nobody knows what the heck you're talking about, right? Whereas, yes, justice is, which is a manifestation of that right relationship with other people and with God.
Okay, well, let's actually, this is triggering something I think is really important, because this comes up all the time when I talk to people. Righteousness or justice, it's not just ours, but it's God's, right? So God's justice, I mean, maybe if I'm understanding Romans correctly, that seems to be something Paul is trying to defend in Romans, like, is God just? Is God righteous? And explain that. What's the issue here? You know, why is God's righteousness? Why does Paul talk? What does he mean by God's righteousness? Let's just leave it at that. What does he mean by God's righteousness or justice?
Well, one way to translate that, God's righteousness, might be God's covenantal faithfulness to set things right. But here's why it's an issue. In the ancient world, the question of whether any of the gods were powerful or were faithful had to do usually with military victory, right? So you could say that Zeus or Jupiter was powerful, that Rome was powerful, because those gods were aligned together to defeat their enemies, right? They were they had military yeah. might and military power. In the story of Israel, this was a real challenge, because when the people were taken into exile, the question was, is God actually powerful anymore? Is God mm-hmm. is God just? Does God have covenantal faithfulness towards us any longer?
Yeah, will God do right by his people?
Will God do right by his people?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in the first century, you have these Jews who have been expelled from Rome. They're shamed people. They're in Rome in the first place because they've been captured from their homeland. And the question is God still faithful to them? Is God still able to enact justice and righteousness for them? And that puts this big question mark behind God's faithfulness and God's righteousness. And the answer that Romans gives is this paradoxical answer of suffering, that God is actually faithful in the midst of suffering, that Jesus is righteous and just and faithful by dying for his enemies. This is in Romans 5, not in condemning his enemies, but, you know, while we were still sinners, Jesus died for us. While we were enemies, God acted reconciliation for us. So there's this paradox that this God is faithful because Jesus has been willing to suffer and die for us. And that's why Paul says in chapter 8, we are more than conquerors in our suffering. He kind of eclipses the whole category of what a conqueror mm-hmm. usually is. So you would say that Caesar was just because, well, he's winning, right? And Paul's saying, no, that's not true at all. That's not the criteria anymore for mm-hmm. who is just and who is righteous. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you've mentioned in that section talking about God's justice, the idea of Jesus dying, and you use the word for us. And so can you say more about how Romans and atonement theories and what was the meaning of Jesus' death in this context that you're reading it?
At this point, I'm just going to let Sylvia keep talking.
Okay.
Well,
smart move,
you know,
Brian.
That's
smart move.
I mean, that's a huge question, atonement theories. I think the way that Romans talks about it, I mean, Romans doesn't say too much about how atonement happens or anything, really. I mean, you know, what it says in chapter 5 is, you know, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son. And much more surely, having been reconciled, we will be saved by his life. You know, and just before that, he says, while we were sinners, Christ died for us. And the point Paul's making isn't so much, you know, how this happened, but that the way of reconciliation that God chooses isn't a way of reconciliation that insists on violence, that insists that enemies have to be punished, and it's not a way of reconciliation that's based in judgment, right? It's based in God's love for us. That's how reconciliation happens in Jesus. And so, you know, Jesus' death on the cross isn't because God was so angry that somebody had to die to kind of satisfy God's wrath. That's not the point of Romans. I mean, Romans 5 says, but God proves his love for us that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So what does atonement mean in Romans? Why did Jesus die in Romans? Because God loved us so much that he was willing to offer himself up for us.
Yeah, and how all that works is not super clear.
And nor does it need to be.
Yeah.
It seems to me that asking the question of atonement of Romans is perhaps asking the wrong question. Because Romans, Paul doesn't in any way really tell us what happens on that on the cross. What is there some sort of transaction that happens there? That's later questions being put to Paul. But what's clear in Paul is that love wins. That's what's clear. Mm-hmm. Love wins. And that for love to win requires God to so enter into our condition that God, in fact, will embrace us even though we are enemies as we are doing our worst to God's very Son.
Mm-hmm. Cross is then like ultimate anti-empire rhetoric.
You bet.
Oh, definitely.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's a symbol of the empire. It's an implement of the empire. And while Paul doesn't use the same kind of language that we see in Colossians, where the cross is the place where Christ in fact takes captive those who put him on the cross, the imagery is still there. It's really interesting. We've called our book Romans Disarmed, and of course one of the great weapons of the empire was the cross itself, and it's at the cross that the empire is in fact disarmed.
Yeah, talk about paradox.
Hey, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, can you maybe explain that a little bit more? Because I think that it feels, just for our listeners, that can feel kind of abstract. Because I think in what ways is Rome disarmed there at the cross? Can you say a little bit more about, you know, Pete's statement that the cross is anti-imperialistic and it is still a tool of the empire? How does that, maybe can you say a little more about that? How does that work?
Well, you know, the empire's power lay in its military might and in its violence, right? That's how it inflicted power and exerted its power and control. If in its violent actions, if it's robbed of that power in its violent actions, if instead of its violence defeating its enemies. Instead, those enemies are empowered to say that, no, they are actually, in suffering love, going to bear this violence and they're not going to return it. Then that actually disarms the empire because it loses its control in that. I mean, Paul actually says at one point in Romans 13 that we ought not to owe anybody anything except love, right? The empire counts on people fighting back. It counts on inciting violence because then it can respond in violence and maintain its control. But if in the face of violence, people are acting out of love and people are instead of getting on the bandwagon of hating the things the empire hates, people are instead acting in love towards those that the empire excludes and to those who are most marginalized. That undermines everything that imperial power is trying to do.
And of course, the linchpin in all of this is the resurrection. That the empire does its worst, but love still wins. Resurrection overpowers death. And so then, because Jesus is risen and invites us into that risen life, that is an invitation to live in this world, embracing this world as new creation, embracing this world as the site of God's justice, embracing this world in a way which is no longer subject to the empire.
You know, this whole thing is, you might remember U2's album, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. Somebody asked Bono when that album came out, so how do you dismantle an atomic bomb? And Bono said, with love. And That's exactly the point that we're making in Romans Disarmed, and that Paul makes, I think, in Romans 12.
So in some ways, the cross and then subsequently the resurrection are representations of how to render empiric violence ineffective.
That's right.
And that is through through love, mm-hmm. And through peace, mm-hmm. which for me, the kind of the opposites is, I think biblically, the opposite of love is fear, right? So the cross represents trying to induce fear, and it induces violence, mm-hmm. right. and aggression. So you oppose it either through being afraid of it, or you oppose it through violence, but mm-hmm. love, and the cross and the resurrection sort of paint this new picture and renders those things ineffective. It doesn't have the effect that it was supposed to have, mm-hmm. or it often did have.
That's right. And I think I just want to qualify that by probably saying suffering love, because mm-hmm. one of the points that we make about Romans, and one of the ways that we read Romans, is as a letter of lament, that that Paul is writing to people who are at the bottom of the social ladder in the empire, and their laments enter into his writing, but also that the lament of God is woven throughout the letter. So I'm, you know, when we were talking earlier about the cross and what happens on the cross, that it's kind of the culmination of the whole story, the whole biblical story of the God of the Old Testament who is lamenting over Israel and lamenting over Israel's sin and lamenting over Israel's unfaithfulness. I mean, the Godward side of judgment is always grief and lament, right? And the prophets embody that. And so when Paul is saying in Romans 1:18, the wrath of God is unveiled, he's not saying that as, isn't this great? He's saying, and here again in sorrow, this is how God is responding to what's going on. Romans 9:11, of course, has that the most deeply, where there's this lament over Israel, and you had creation lamenting in Romans chapter 8. So throughout this letter, there's this language of lament, and then that call to love is a call to identify with the laments of those who cry out, who groan in Romans 8, right? Mm-hmm. We're called to a suffering love that joins in with the lament of those who are crying out for the kingdom to come and crying out for the resurrection.
And tell me what you think of this, because something that just popped into my head here is the, you know, a love that is a suffering love. And it's also I'm thinking of the honor-shame dynamic in the first century. It's also a humiliating love. It's the taking on of humiliation, which is the opposite of the power dynamic of first century life, political life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Paul turns the shame-honor dynamic on its head.
Which is why, you know, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation. I used to think that meant you have to witness to your friends on the lunch line or something. But it's he's not saying I'm not afraid to talk about it. He's saying I'm not ashamed. Well, why would you be ashamed? Well, mm-hmm. look at it. Look how this religion, so to speak, starts. It starts with God participating somehow in the grand act of humiliation on the part of the people in power.
That's right. So Paul is saying there that I'm not ashamed of the gospel, and because I will not play by the rules that the empire has around shame. In fact, I will stand with those who are the most shamed by the empire. You know, and when I think about not being ashamed of the gospel, it's actually pretty hard these days, because I look at the way in which the gospel has been used to embrace white supremacy and nationalism, and the move towards fascism in the highest office of the United States, and 80% of American white evangelicals supporting this. Then it's really hard to be ashamed. It's hard not to be ashamed, but you then have to struggle and say, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, I'm ashamed of the way in which it has been distorted. I'm ashamed of the way in which it's been used as a weapon. I'm ashamed of the way in which it's been co-opted. And so that's kind of
empire.
By empire, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly right. Which is the very different reason why Paul said, I'm not ashamed.
That's right. That's exactly. Right.
You know.
Yeah. And, you know, at some point somebody's going to ask, if you talk about Romans and you talk about politics, well, gee, what about Romans 13, you know?
Yeah, what about Romans 13? Yeah. Go ahead. Well, get out of this one, guys. Come on.
Just one of the first things I want to say is some years ago I preached a sermon which was called To Hell with Romans 13. And and by which I didn't mean to hell with what Paul is saying, but to hell with the way in which Romans 13 has been used to legitimate all kinds of evil and co-opting by empire, you know. Romans 13 needs to be read, oddly enough, within the context of Romans. You know, how could it be that Paul, after presenting in Romans 12 a rich vision and charter for what an alternative community looks like, radically alternative to the empire, would then say, oh, and but by the way, just keep on obeying the authorities? No, I think that what Paul is saying there is, these guys aren't kidding, and you better be careful. You know, watch your back around the state. And we could do the whole exegesis, but what I find really interesting is to come back to that theme of love, where Paul says, owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one who loves another has fulfilled law. Our Bibles will say the law. There's no definite article there. It's fulfilled law. Law, if it's to be just law, and law should always be just law, has to be law that reflects love. And that means, I think, that if we come upon law and legislation and policies and political forces that are engaging in acts that are the opposite of love, then Romans 13 calls us to a radical civil disobedience to that kind of law, because that's not the fulfillment. Love is only is the fulfillment of law, and any law that cannot match and cannot be stand before the bar of love must be disobeyed.
Well, it seems like a wonderful place to end our times. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time, but I think it's a good practical note to end on. But is there anything that you would point people to? Of course, you have your book, Romans Disarmed, and we'll talk about that as we, Pete and I, record the outro. But is there anything else, projects, organizations, other things that you're involved in that you would want to mention?
Well, I'd want to mention two. One is that the book, Romans Disarmed, is dedicated to a community in Toronto called Sanctuary. The book begins at in a sorrowful moment at Sanctuary. Sanctuary is a community amongst the most dispossessed, especially Indigenous folks in downtown Toronto. And we are very close to that community. And if folks are ever in Toronto, you want to check out Sanctuary. The other thing I want to refer folks to is, we have a website called Empire Remixed that we've been running for many years. And on Empire Remixed, we have actually a page for Romans Disarmed. And hopefully within the next couple of weeks, we'll have a study guide that will be posted at Empire Remixed for our book.
Oh, that's great. Practical stuff for a practical message.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, listen, Sylvia and Brian, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This was really stimulating, and I learned some stuff today, that's for sure, about Romans and thinking about it differently. Appreciate it very much.
Our pleasure.
Good talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone, to this episode of The Bible for Normal People. And be sure to pick up a copy of Romans Disarmed by Sylvia Keesmaat and Brian Walsh, put out by the good people at Brazos Press, a division of Baker Publishing Group, which I've published a book or two with. Good people.
Yes, and once you go into that, people have now tuned out and are snoozing. But if you haven't, if you're still with us, we would really encourage you to just check out patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople. That's where we really have gathered a community of people around the Bible for Normal People, just discussions about the Bible, about faith, about any number of things. I'm sure you could talk about whatever you want and you'd probably get someone to respond to you, but it really does center around all of our questions about faith, doubt, the Bible. How does it all fit? How does it all work? So just go to patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople, and for as little as $1 a month, you can join there, watch videos, be on Slack, all kinds of other things. So go check it out. We hope to see you there.
Thanks, folks.